Welcome to Pizza Cultura, part of the Pizza Club series of conversation. I'm here with Peter and Tom. As usual, you're in the right place for pizza if you like to talk about pizza. Guys, the topic of today, how far would you travel for a pizza? Let's start right away with the question. How far would you travel for a pizza, or did you travel for a pizza? And then I'll tell you why I thought of this topic. Peter, what about you?
Well, the farthest I would probably travel under normal times would probably be a little bit over half an hour. The farthest ever I have traveled just solely to get a pizza, not for any other reason, and I'm not traveling on vacation or anything like that, was about 75 miles or about an hour and a half by car. And that was just to get the pizza. And I have to say, it was worth it. Because they had good... Racine, Wisconsin, Wells Brothers, a very well-known now tavern style of Chicago thin crust. They are an old tavern, but started pizza in the early 50s. And they sort of preserved, I would call them, one of the original styles of thin crust pizza. They got the whole thing from Chicago. So it was sort of like an enclave that sort of preserved the old way of doing things. Anyway, it's very good, and it just shows the, I would say, the level of skill, if you're willing to put in the time and to preserve the tradition, how good it can be. And it's well known now that, but it's a little farther away for people in Chicago to go to. So it's an interesting arbitrage opportunity. If someone were to train up there to learn from that pizza, they could bring it back, and that wouldn't be, you know, it's right
Peter.
There for you.
Peter, Wisconsin, correct me if I'm wrong, is the cheese factory of America, right?
Yes, they use Grande cheese. Yes.
Yeah, cheese factory of America. Yeah, but not just
I had something totally different there, Pepe. So.
I don't know. I don't want to know what you heard.
Yeah,
okay. Don't go there.
But I mean, it's not just Grande. I mean, usually it's where they make all the Parmesan, all the Brick cheese. Is that correct?
Right. It's got a rich tradition of Italian cheese makers that go back before the war. And sometimes I wonder if geographic proximity to Wisconsin changes the diet so that you end up putting more cheese on pizza. I don't know. I just have that feeling, and that's been my experience in my lifetime, that thin crust pizza in Chicago tends to emphasize the cheese as opposed to the origin of pizza, which of course was always in America, the tomato pie. In the Midwest, it sort of evolved or devolved into the cheese pie, which I take as a distinctly bad turn in the evolution.
Oh, you're not a cheese fan?
I'm fine with cheese, all in proportion.
Just not an overabundance.
Just keep in mind proportion, and there's that. So this is a perfect thing for Tom too. I think I look at cheese as being sort of like the bass guitar in a group, Tom, that you don't really hear it all the time, but if it's missing, you really notice it. That's like
good
the
analogy.
Mutz. I'm not talking about the hard cheese, but the Mutz, I'm not really tasting Mutz that much, but if it's missing the weight of it, that fat, you miss it. Just doesn't. It feels like toast almost. You know, you need that cheese to balance it. But so anyway, the bass guitar, Mutz.
We should engrave this metaphor on every pizzeria. Like, consider your pizza
as a rock band. Yeah.
Well,
who's the Ringo Starr of pizza though?
Well, we can take that analogy farther and say there are pop bands and there are more sophisticated bands. So what would be the analogy of a pop band in pizza? But here I am getting off topic and we've just started. I should shut up for now.
Well, Peter, for the sake of conversation, the travel doesn't have to be solely for pizza. I mean, let's face it, any of us would always find something of their interest wherever they go. So if your interest is pizza, even if you haven't traveled right for pizza, it counts.
I'm not buying that. Because that confounds it. I will go to Naples, right? So that doesn't count. I will go to Brooklyn. That doesn't count for me. Or Trenton, God forbid.
I'll tell you what. I planned a lot of trips around a lot of travels, not a lot of trips, a lot of travels around pizza, but also on the other way around. I plan a lot of travel just for the sake of going to the country. But sure. Then I immediately, on the at the beginning of my planning my travel, I immediately checked if there were some pizzas.
Well,
and some.
I want to interject to Peter's point about Trenton. I think for many people, possibly, and I'm going to get hate from some friends for this, but the only reason they'd ever go near Trenton is for pizza.
I've gone. No, well, if you're doing a book, they've got a great archive there, so I would go for that.
I mean, they have a beautiful courthouse as well, but I mean, I went for the pizza.
It's grim. Yeah, no, it's grim.
I have no idea what you're talking about. So.
If you want to say it that way.
Yeah, I mean, it's grimy in a good way, but it's not a destination that people often include in like a bucket.
If you like the history, it's great. It's but it's sobering to go there, I have to say. And a lot of the famous pizzerias have moved out.
Secondigliano.
Okay, and for people who don't know what Secondigliano is, think of the series
then
Gomorra.
Trenton.
No, or think of the series Gomorra if you have watched it, so you know what we're talking about. So what about you, Tom? How far would you travel or have you traveled for a pizza? I mean, you fly
so
quite
very
often
germane...
between London and New York.
Yeah, but that, I mean...
And
his
beloved
I
Australia.
I can't say that I traveled there for pizza. I mean, I live halfway between New York and London and Australia.
You live in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean?
Yeah, yeah. I'm what they call a nylon in New York, London. But and Australia, I was kind
feature.
Of... I was imprisoned there
cable.
Against my will. So that wasn't for pizza. But I did have fantastic pizza in Melbourne. Shout out to Ali at Sunnyside. In fact, that's probably one of... I don't know if that's the furthest, but that was a good... That was a good train ride away, maybe 40 minutes or something.
And you went there just to go to that spot?
Just to see Sunnyside.
Well, in that case, that's a long journey to have a pizza.
Yeah, I mean, I guess a comparable distance to where I went today. So yeah, your question is a very germane, Pepe, because today I did a rare kind of trip outside of my neighborhood in London and went to Forno, which is I don't know if it's actually Italian owned and run, but it's a very Italian deli pastries and
well, I have to say, when I was living in London and you didn't have the plethora of good Neapolitan pizzerias that you have today, and the majority of them were on the outskirts of London, sometimes I would even travel I would take 1 hour tube time just to eat a pizza that I deemed it was worth my journey, which
yeah,
for someone living in London,
you had to do that back in the day.
Yeah,
you had to do,
I mean,
yeah.
It,
but no.
It,
I mean, so to just to finish, today was it was maybe an hour's travel, half an hour in the tube and half an hour walking.
It is strange because I had done several journeys around the world, and some of them they were planned around pizza, but it feels actually more stressful when you live in a city and within that city you have to travel such a long distance to eat something. Because, for example, if I take a flight to Tokyo, for example, then once I'm in Tokyo, I know that I have dozens and dozens of pizzeria to choose from. So technically, within Tokyo, I won't travel such a long distance. But when I'm in London and from zone one, for example, I have to go all the way to zone six, which I have done in the past, like 1 hour tube ride, then it's a long journey, which
London's a very disparate city in that regard. Like
it's a
county. You don't have this
London is contiguity. Not just a city, it's a county. So it is vast. But anyway, I thought of the question, I thought of the topic of the day, not just related to my travels, because I could say, yes, the farthest I traveled was either Tokyo to the east or Las Vegas to the west, and I haven't been to Australia yet. But it came to me one day that I was at Franco Pepe in Caiazzo. And thinking that once you go there, I mean, we all have to assume here that people that are listening to this podcast know who Franco Pepe is and what he has done to the pizza world and how the small village of Caiazzo became sort
not,
of
not
a
not to
centerpiece.
Be confused with Frank Pepe. In
yeah,
UN,
exactly.
Just in case.
Yeah, just in case. But anyway, yes, Franco Pepe, Caiazzo, small village on top of a hill of the countryside of the Campania region. We're talking about a 1 hour car drive from Naples, and that guy managed to just put that place on a map and make it the centerpiece of pizza all around the world. And you go there, you go at this pizzeria, which, by the way, call it just a pizzeria, it's an understatement, but you really see people from all around the world, and you have to assume that the majority of those people have been there just for him. Like, probably they have traveled, they have planned a trip with the Franco Pepe in mind, because even if they did it with him in mind, they at least planned a trip to Naples, and they decided that a trip to Caiazzo was worth it just to eat his pizza.
Undoubtedly.
Yeah. Because you wouldn't see otherwise people coming from Australia, from America, from whatever country, a lot of Asian people, of course, from Russia for sure, just in that restaurant in a small village of Campania because they were there just by chance. No, for sure they went there. So I was thinking, like, how is that even possible that people travel from other hemisphere, really, just to eat a pizza, which it's not an everyday experience anyway.
To bring it, I'm hoping Peter will have a Chicagoan example, but back in, I guess, as late as the kind of early 2000s, people, and by which I mean kind of pizza geeks, were traveling to New York, to go to Brooklyn, to go to Midwood, to go to Avenue J, just for Di Fara. Like, that was a real destination spot. You'd bump into, oh, you know, where are you from? Oh, I'm from London. Oh, what were you doing here? Oh, I've just come to go. You've come all the way here to go Di Fara? Yeah. So there are these kind of real magnetic spots that will pull people from far and wide.
But how many people can actually afford such a journey? It's like those people that are really into Michelin star restaurants, and they travel all the way to Copenhagen to eat at Noma, or in the past where they went to go to Ferran Adrià in Spain. I don't remember which side of Spain was that, because I'm not a Michelin star restaurant type. But still, a lot of, actually, in the world of Michelin star restaurants, it's actually quite common that people travel just to go and eat to that restaurant. And I actually like the fact that the pizza world got this popularity as well. Like, people, as you call them, pizza geeks, like, let's call them pizza geeks, but they might just be like food passionate, like foodies, but they would travel just to eat that particular type of pizza. Now, if you go to Naples, it's easy. You can go to Naples, and there are a lot of famous names where to eat from. But you are in the birthplace of pizza, and that's the same thing. If you go to New York, there are so many good pizzerias where to choose from. So it's actually an easy task. But when you go to Naples, and then you have to face that 1 hour journey just to go to Caiazzo, which is not an easy journey, because yes, you can go there by train, but still the way back, it's not going to be easier. And that's in fact why the whole Franco Pepe business actually created a lot of income for the local business, because a lot of bed and breakfast sprawled around the pizzerias for people to stay at night, which is great. It's great. I mean, one single man managed to create an whole tourist income to a small village.
Yeah, it reminds me, and Pepe, you've heard us talk about this occasionally. Roberta's in Greenpoint. Is it Greenpoint? Yeah, Greenpoint in Brooklyn was basically credited with creating that neighborhood, which I'm sure will ruffle some people's feathers, and no offense intended, but you know, Roberta's became a destination spot, and the entire neighborhood just kind of built up around it, and it's now a very cool and trendy place to live in Brooklyn. It's amazing the kind of pull that these places can have.
How many places would you say have created something like that in the United States? Because, for example, if I have to think of Italy, I can only think of a handful of names, really not so many people to the level of Franco Pepe. Again, when we are getting far away from a pizza hub like it's Naples, because you could meet so many popular names in Naples. But in Italy, I will just consider people like Franco Pepe first, of course. Simone Padoan in the north, because he is the, I don't know if you ever heard of him, but he's the one that is mostly credited to create the whole movement of contemporary pizza, which is not to be confused with the southern contemporary pizza, which is all the Canotto thing and stuff.
Oh, what's northern contemporary?
Well, the whole concept of contemporary pizza is actually vaster than you think. Because when we're talking about contemporary pizza, we're talking about two different concepts. So the evolution of pizza as comfort food to a, don't hate me for the word, gourmet food, which means a higher research of the raw materials. I mean, when we're talking about, yeah, when we're talking about not just the classic 00 flours, but better high quality flours, maybe produced by local mills or made with different grains. Same things with the toppings. So you start from the from the ingredients to create something new that is not just the classic pizza, but it's a pizza. You create a whole experience around pizza. So you create fabulous toppings, you create recipes that have been unseen before on pizza. You create a different way to eat pizza, which is the tasting way of eating pizza. So you don't just eat a pizza by yourself, but you eat you order several pizzas at a table with other diners. So you share with these people, and the pizza is presented with
like a pizza omakase type thing.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Oh, omakase, like a sushi tasting where the chef kind of serves you. And
it's not really like a chef's table, because anyway, Simone Padoan is a proper restaurant where you order a table and you sit. But mm-hmm. that, I mean, we call it pizza degustazione, which is
okay.
Actually,
yeah,
it's the proper way to call it, because that's like the contemporary movement how it evolved up north. It became up north with people
Franco Pepe himself is doing one of those now, I believe.
I mean, he has a chef's table, but that's different. It's two different concepts, because the northern contemporary movement, it's about quality stuff, quality ingredients, quality raw materials. So starting from the flour, then the ingredients, and then the recipes, and then the way to have your pizzas. So, and by the way, the menu is expensive as well, because it's all, it's like a Michelin star experience. So you have you can also have sort of I don't know how to translate it in English. We call it percorso degustazione, which is like when you can have a different tasting of different kind of pizzas. And usually you do it with other people, but you might do it also on your own as well. So you have just one slice of pizza with that particular kind of ingredients, and you have that for all the evening. That's the contemporary, the pizza contemporanea, contemporary pizza that started all the way in the north with the names like Simone Padoan or Renato Bosco. When we talk about contemporary pizza in the south, it's most the concept is similar. So the concept of looking for the high quality, using different flours, using high quality ingredients, creating alternative recipes, that stays. But it was mostly associated with the Canotto movement. So nowadays,
I've only heard until now, I'd only ever heard Southerners referred to contemporary pizza, and they
because that's the most popular concept. I mean, the whole word contemporanea was actually popularized from that particular movement, because it's also the one that was popular on Instagram, and they basically took one single trait of that movement, which is the Canotto style pizza. They exported all around Italy, all around Europe, all around abroad, and so now when people think of contemporary pizza, they just think of Canotto.
It's synonymous with, whereas it's actually just one part of.
One part of a very large movement that is also have quite a distinction. In fact, I don't even know if it's correct calling pizza northern contemporary pizza. I mean, it is correct, because that's how they used to call it in the north, but they also call it pizza degustazione. They call it in so many ways. But yes, by the way, there are people that are traveling long distances just to go to Simone Padoan. His restaurant is called Itigli. And that's a place where you have to book in advance. That's a place where you will go there and you know that you're not going to spend less than probably 90 euros per person, and so on and so on. Which is interesting because it's a sort of a Michelin star like experience. You don't just go there to have a pizza. You go there to have a full-fledged experience.
I'm just Googling his pizza now.
Yeah, so do you have any similar names in the US that provide you that kind of experience of where people happily travel to, like they take flights to go there or whatever?
I mean, the thing that came to my mind, it isn't a direct analogy, but basically we're saying that they're willing to make a great sacrifice to go there and to, in our case, wait in line, was Lucali in Brooklyn. I would think fits that mold. City of New Haven, which has three or four major ones that people will wait in line for. Chicago has a few, and interesting enough, they're sort of developing. I mean, this whole phenomena, I don't think, would really exist without the internet and the distribution of information and pictures that people can tell their stories. So they're really going for they're going for the pizza, but the pizza is part of the story. And they're really trying to capture a story, I think, and then present it to everyone else. So without cell phones and without the web, yeah.
Yeah, no, I think I got the point. I think that this is especially true for pizza because pizza became pop thanks to Instagram, the social media, and so on. Because in the past, if we're talking about food in general, in the past, people used to travel for Michelin star restaurants even way before the advent of the social media. That's because you had the guides, you had the food writer that would write article about it. So people that could afford to travel, and those are that kind of people are actually the target of a food magazine and whatsoever. They will read this article, they will buy these books, these guides, and they will travel. Even in Italy, I mean, pizza has become pretty popular in the food guides, meaning like you know the guide that come they are published regularly every year by the same magazine or by the same publishing houses. But in the past, they were not considered at all, so it was just restaurants.
I have a question. Go ahead, Peter.
Well, I was just going to say, if we go back far enough, we can sort of see the trend of the democratization of this phenomena. So if you go back to the 19th century, they used to go on the Grand Tour. And where would they go? They would go to Naples. And in part, that's what some of the earliest writing that we have on pizza in Napoli. I was just going to say, there is sort of another phenomena where if you reverse what's happening and you get the actual proprietor or the pizzaioli or the pizza maker would be traveling instead of the public traveling. So for example, in Chicago, Franco Pepe, who was talked about before, actually traveled to Spaccanapoli about a decade ago, and I had his pie there. So I didn't have to travel all the way to Italy. He came to me. So, and it-
Not many people can say that, Peter. That's
no,
pretty,
but
that's pretty
I mean,
badass.
No,
Franco
but I mean,
Pepe comes to me.
Right. Well, he did come to, I think it was after he went to Pizza Expo, he was going back.
I'm just teasing.
The larger point is that could be not just that particular example, but that could be a phenomena that could be an example for some other group to do. Like you could have a tour of pizza makers that are traveling the world. Maybe they could be sponsored by a flower company. I don't know. You know, it's like all these things are on the table, I think, to do in the future.
Tom, what was your question?
I was just going to ask if either of you have, and I'm assuming odds are that Pepe is more likely to have eaten at Simone Padoan's eating.
Actually, I have not. That's the thing. Because I didn't manage to, I mean, I told you, I went all the way to Las Vegas, all the way to Tokyo and to so many other countries, and I never managed to go to Simone Padoan.
I'm going to say something controversial.
Bye.
It looks amazingly tasty and a real kind of, you know, gastronomic experience. But And look, this is kind of sophistry and semantics and whatever, but it looks more like bread with stuff on it rather than pizza.
Well, because that's not a pizza how you would expect it, and definitely not a Neapolitan pizza. It's mostly pizza al padellino.
Mm.
Have you ever heard of pizza al padellino?
Super tasty, and I would inhale it, but it just looks a bit kind of deconstructed. I don't know.
It is. I mean, it's not a coincidence that it is up north where the concept of pizza al padellino is more popular. But again, pizza al padellino.
I need a translation of that.
Yeah, which means basically pan pizza, round pan pizza.
Exactly.
Pan. Not the tray, but the pan pizza, which is done in so many parts of Italy, and it takes a different name everywhere you go. In Campania, it's called pizza nel ruoto. In Turin, it's called pizza al tegamino. In Milan, it's called pizza al trancio. And by the way, it does differ in every places for small things like the baking. So if it's baked, if it's cooked in an electric oven, a gas oven, wood fired oven, or if it's, they use oil or whatever.
I was thinking about, just a quick tangent, but I was thinking about that today when it comes to kind of the nomenclature for Roman styles and how unhelpful they are, because al taglio, by the slice, is arguably completely meaningless because every pizza is eventually eaten by the slice. Intaglia, in pan, but intaglia is also al taglio. So, I know they're not the same thing. But I've never seen an intaglia that isn't eventually al taglio.
Yeah. Well, anyway, just not to create any confusion, because that's the thing. Because when you say pan pizza, to you, it doesn't matter if it's a round pan or if it's a tray, right? You still call it pan pizza. Whereas to us,
if it's made in a pan.
Yeah, exactly. To us, makes a great difference, because when we say pizza intaglia, we know that it's the square pan, the rectangular pan. When we say pizza al padellino, pizza al tegamino, pizza nel rugello, they are all circular. No, pizza alla palla, it doesn't have anything to do with the pan pizza. So when we say all these things, those are always the circular pans. So that's why I was saying there are slight...
But intaglia is not circular.
Intaglia is not circular, that's the thing.
Yeah, but that's in a pan.
But that's what I'm saying. I mean, when you say... When you say pan pizza, pan pizza, right? Do you consider both the circular pan and the tray and the square pan? Is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Anything that is literally made in a pan is pan pizza.
Exactly. In Italian, it's not the same. So when we say pizza in teglia, we know with the word teglia, we know that we only talk about the tray. So
the specific teglia.
Yeah, the rectangular or the square one. When we say pizza al padellino, pizza al tegamino, pizza nel ruoto, pizza nel ruccolo, there are so many variations of them. All these words that I'm telling you, they all address the specific tray that is only circular. And they even differ, because those trays might be different because, I don't know, I'm not getting too much into details because there are very slight differences.
I have a question for you, Pepe, so to a novice's ears from America, the confusion is, are these terms like post-World War II terms? Like, what would be the difference between any of these things that you're talking about, calling them pizza and focaccia? That's what I want to know.
Well, for focaccia, I would use the definition that I heard from Scott Winner, which I think it fits. It really fits. People might disagree, but I think it fits. So focaccia is when you first bake the dough and then you top it. Whereas when you bake the dough with the toppings, it's a pizza. But again, it's arguable because you might find examples of pizza that don't fit this description or focaccia that don't fit this description. So
under that system, the focaccia always has the toppings post-baked. So it's not just baked, but it doesn't get rebaked then. It's not like power baked and then you add the toppings and then you shove it in again.
That's a very interesting question, because who is to say that that cannot be called a focaccia, because you might do
one,
like
one man's focaccia is another man's pizza.
Well, modernist cuisine I think said focaccia. Maybe I'm out of it. I don't know if my memory is right, but I think they said that a pizza cannot be served cold. That was one of the distinctions. And I think one of the implications was focaccia was preferably served cold, which is an interesting way to distinguish it, because I never would have thought that.
Again, right. That's debatable, because
sure,
then
all of
then,
this is.
Yeah, because then what makes of this a pizza portafoglio? Pizza portafoglio itself cold, and it is a pizza.
But it's folded.
Yeah, exactly. So you see, we are in
cold?
The pizza portafoglio can be served cold, because
can be, but isn't necessarily.
No, it's not necessarily hot, neither cold, because that is pre-made. It's put on display.
That I get. Yeah.
And that's the same with focaccia. I mean, if you're the lucky one that comes into the shop when the focaccia has been just baked, you get it hot. You don't get it cold.
Well, the reason why that one, and again, I mean, I am but a peon, and I would never disagree with Scott on any of this stuff. But the reason why I kind of went, ooh, is because I've never been into an intaglia spot that doesn't top things post-bake. But then I certainly think it's fair to call intaglia pizza rather than focaccia. Like...
But even that, it's like when you say pizza bianca, okay? Pizza bianca romana. Pizza bianca is a focaccia, because it is baked. You don't put anything on top. It's just plain.
Pizza rossa.
Exactly. Well, but the
bianca has salt and olive oil, right?
Salt, olive oil, maybe some rosemary.
But do you really consider topping?
Well, I mean, again, we had so yeah, I do actually, because I mean,
but
if you go back far enough, all of these
they
are toppings, right?
Yeah. Okay. But that's the thing, because even the pizza rossa, anyway, the red sauce, it's a topping and goes within the bake. But I mean, would you really call them? I mean, they are called pizza, but when you think of what pizza generally is considered, would you really call the pizza bianca a pizza, like in the most when you consider the most popular image of pizza that people have?
No, I mean me in my limited reductive worldview, and this is how utterly arbitrary it is. I would consider pizza bianca a focaccia, but pizza rossa a pizza.
Yeah,
because I'm
but
an idiot.
If you consider also that the pizza bianca usually is made to be sliced and filled with ingredients, so that most similar to focaccia. But again, we are in the realm of opinions, because at the end of the day. It's the language is so common. It's like the same way why the Chicago pizza, the deep dish pizza is a pizza and is not considered a cake, for example.
Someone should do a book on that.
Yeah, someone should. But anyway, I mean, we completely diverted from the original topic, which was fun. I really love that. But I think we went over the average 30 minutes, which is always a pleasure to go over with you guys, because we really go and explore all the nuances of the pizza world and terminology. To be continued. So I suppose this is the time to say goodbye. We don't know the topic for next week as usual, because it's always going to be improvised.
No, but there will be a show.
That will be a show. Okay, perfect. So as usual, please subscribe and follow us on whichever platform you are listening to us or watching to us. If it's YouTube, subscribe on YouTube. If it's on a podcast, please subscribe on the podcast. Give us a like, give us a rating, whatever you can do.
And some could be the first to make a comment. I don't think we've had one comment so far.
Well, whatever.
To be honest, I'm a little bit braced for just the comments being a torrid of abuse, but yeah.
No, actually, I would love for the comments to
Tom
to
loves
to
abuse.
Pour on our, we don't love abuse. But anyway,
I'm not sure if you said this, but the handle for our socials is I Need Pizza Club, all one word.
Yes, thanks for managing. Actually, please go ahead. Also, subscribe to the newsletters that you can find on I Need Pizza dot club is that no sorry I need dot pizza on the website. That's where you can find the website and where you can subscribe to the newsletter. Actually, let's also remind our handle on Instagram. So mine is pizza.dixit. Peter, what's yours, where people can find you on Instagram?
Best one is pizza history book.
Tom, what about you?
No one wants to follow me. My content isn't very pizza related, so I'm best not, just follow I Need Pizza Club and these two, not me. I'm massively underwhelming.
And on this note of sadness, that's a wrap, guys. See you next week. Thanks for chatting with us, and long live pizza.
Lovely chatting to you both.
Bye bye.
Bye bye.